Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics, nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Deborah Witzberg is the Inspector General of the City of Chicago. The city's hosting the Democratic National Convention in August, and there are real concerns about the ability of Chicago police to handle the likely demonstrations. Ms. Witzberg, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Deborah, Chicago is hosting the Democratic National Convention in August, and the Chicago Police Department leaders have been working on designing policies to prevent, hopefully, the same types of mistakes that were made during the protests and violence triggered by the 2020 murder of George Floyd. In your mind, what were those mistakes, and how are the policies that the CPD is designing addressing those concerns?
So back in 2021, we issued a report that looked at the city's response to those protests and unrest following the murder of George Floyd, and we identified areas of structural systemic failure in that response, including failures in mass arrest processing, failures in planning, and gaps in policy. We also identified ways in which the structure of that operational response undermined accountability for things that went wrong, and plenty went wrong, frankly, in that 2020 response. We recently released a report which looked at those areas of concerns which we identified from the 2020 response, as well as areas of shortcomings which CPD itself identified in the 2020 response. CPD did some after-action review of that response. They also identified some areas of concern and failure and shortcoming. And so the intent of this recent report was to sort of mark progress, to look at where we are compared to where things were in 2020, with an eye toward assessing the city's readiness for the DNC and for what is, I think, are likely to be accompanying mass events. I think the bottom line here is that, without a doubt, we are a great deal better off than we were in 2020. I think it's really important that we all sort of share that view of the bottom line here. CPD has done substantially more and better planning, including drafting and testing coordinated plans with other city departments and other supportive agencies. There have been things like tabletop exercises, et cetera, to run through some of those plans. There have been important improvements in things like inventories of deployable equipment. So one of the real accountability obstacles that we saw in the 2020 response had to do with body-worn cameras, sort of a very logistical thing. But many, many, many CPD members were deployed out into the 2020 response without body-worn cameras. And that had to do with, you know, where they were deployed from and how the assignments worked and where the equipment was stored, et cetera. The city reports what I believe to be real improvements in the system for making sure that everybody deploys with a body-worn camera. The city has more city-owned vehicles at its control and disposal for transporting members, et cetera. So there are some very sort of like brass tacks improvements with respect to equipment. And I think that it's important to say that some of the areas in policy where we identified lack of clarity and gaps and opportunities for confusion have been addressed in CPD's new draft policies. To go a little further in the weeds there, one of the areas we looked at in the 2020 response had to do with reporting of the use of force. Under ordinary circumstances, in the course of regular policing, if a CPD member deploys certain kinds of force, they are required to fill out a certain form, a tactical response report. The requirements for reporting uses of force are a little bit different in a mass arrest setting. A mass arrest setting is one where there is a possibility or expectation that many people are going to need to be arrested at a time. And we need to have some sort of alternative processing mechanisms so that we can maintain a police presence on the scene of that event. Otherwise, we would have, you know, in the regular procedures, we would have a CPD member leaving the scene to process each arrestee, and that doesn't allow the maintenance of a police presence on the scene of a mass event. So in 2020, in order to kind of fully and comprehensively account for their use of force reporting obligations, CPD members would have had to sort of synthesize 11 separate policies. I think that is not a practical expectation in the context of an emergency response. And even then, there were some sort of gaps. Those things have been meaningfully improved in CPD's new draft policies. There are clearer expectations for use of force reporting. There are clearer guidelines in place for mass arrest events generally. Those are good things. All of those are good things. I do think that there continue to be some areas of persistent concern that we identified in this report.
Let's get to Inspector General. It's impossible to plan for something like the DNC without considering the mass protest really across the world in light of what's been going on in the Middle East. We saw here locally in Chicago, the CPD reacted to protests at DePaul, at Northwestern, at the Art Museum, really all over the city. We saw yesterday in New York and Columbia, a lot of the charges against some of the people arrested and taking over Jefferson Hall there. Those charges were dismissed because of lack of evidence because the cameras were shut off. So what lessons in a relatively short amount of time has your office taken away and has the CPD taken away from some of the police reaction to these protests that we've seen across campuses and elsewhere?
Yeah, I think that's a really critical observation in terms of what's at stake and what we can sensibly expect to see happen here during the DNC. It's a good reminder, too, that this report, the timing of this report, we certainly released this report with an eye toward the DNC specifically and in the hopes that we have left the city enough time to make some continued improvements in these areas of continued concern that we identify. But the fact of the matter is that in a city of Chicago's scale, the DNC will not be the last large event that is here. And in order to prevent the kind of failures that we saw in 2020, CPD and the city must be prepared both for scheduled and spontaneous events. One really critical difference between the 2020 protests and unrest and the DNC is that, right? The DNC has been on the books for a very long time. And while I think there were some intelligence failures that led to the city being caught more by surprise than it need to have been, the fact of the matter is the 2020 protests and unrest were largely unscheduled. That is all to say, I think in terms of looking around at things that are happening elsewhere in the country and what that should tell us, I think that in my mind bodes most strongly for preparedness measures that can be adapted to both these scheduled and spontaneous events with good procedures in place that are built to be shockproof, you know, that are built to withstand unexpected changes in scale and direction and type of mass event.
CPD policy draft stand, because last we heard they're still in draft form. And I think that was one of the issues that you had raised recently, was that there's training that's happening on draft policies rather than waiting until they've been finalized. We'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
That is an area that we identified. So these improved policies, which we talked about, which again, I think do reflect meaningful improvements in content, were as of the writing of our report, still in draft form. Training had begun on those policies. And I think that raised two concerns. One is there's, I think, sort of a common sense risk of confusion, where if we're training people on a draft and there's some chance that draft may change, then, as I say, I think there's a risk of confusion there. The second concern in my mind had to do with sort of the sincerity of CPD's community engagement efforts. So that draft suite of policies was posted for public comment. That public comment period is a community engagement process to which the department has committed. But in the case of this suite of draft policies, training of CPD members began on the policies while they were still posted for public comment. And as I say, I think that risks an appearance that community engagement is insincere, that there's no intention of actually integrating feedback from members of the public into that draft policy. So CPD has issued a new set of drafts of this suite of policy since the publication of our report. And to be clear, we have not evaluated sort of the incremental changes between those two sets of drafts. But I think it is important to say that They've issued new drafts and they've reopened community feedback. That's a good thing. I think it would be better if the policies had been finalized before now, 60 days before the DNC. Here we are. Given that we can't turn the clock back on that, I think kind of coming back to what I hope is a sincere effort at community engagement, I think that's a good thing. And maybe worth just noting here that I have been heartened by sort of how the department has received our report since its publication a few weeks ago. So I think there is this like renewed effort at sincere community engagement. I also think that, we had an opportunity to, CPD invited us to go to McCormick Place and observe some of the field force exercise training that was taking place there. There was a classroom portion and an exercise portion. That training was within days after the publication of our report. And the classroom portion of the training had already been modified to add some clarity on some of the areas we identified where there was, I think, a continuing risk of confusion. And so, that's how this is supposed to work as an oversight endeavor, where we identify areas of risk in the hopes that they can be productively addressed. And then I think we have seen some efforts to productively address them. So I think there's some good news to tell there.
You know that the Secret Service will be involved. We know that state, local police, county police, and even some suburban police will be involved too with the DNC. Thank you so much, Chicago Inspector General Deborah Witzberg, for coming on with us today.
Thank you.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and Leading Lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off. We're joined by Gabe Roth of Fix the Court, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization that advocates for non-ideological fixes to the federal court and the U.S. Supreme Court. Today, we want to chat about Supreme Court justices who have failed to recuse themselves despite conflicts, and justices also banking from their books. Mr. Roth, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me back.
Gabe, as we anxiously await the end of this term, and we were hoping maybe today, but realistically, it sounds like the court is dragging out this immunity decision until the very last minute to keep us all on our toes. We know they added another day, so it might be another few days until we hear whether the President of the United States should be granted immunity. It's hard to even believe that they're still deciding this, but yeah. Lo and behold, they are. In the meantime, we have your excellent report from Fix the Court that has, as Ryan mentioned, shed some additional light. You've done some excellent reporting, as has some other organizations in the past. Dive into some of the gifts, in fact, all of the gifts that the Supreme Court justices have received between 2004 and 23. We'll get into the details in a moment, but it's been widely publicized, again, thanks to a lot of your great reporting, that these justices, who again are the chief judges in the entire United States, receive lavish gifts, private jets, yachts, trips to Indonesia, Beyonce tickets, lots of other stuff. First of all, why are these justices receiving gifts at all?
Well, they shouldn't be. That's sort of the point of my research, is showing the largesse of the luxury accommodations, the private plane travel, the tickets to sporting events, the free $250,000, not free, it was a loan, but it was effectively, the principal was forgiven after a couple of years, nearly free $250,000 luxury RV. You know, these are things that not only are the justices accepting, and Clarence Thomas has accepted probably 90% of the justices' gifts over the last 20 years, but they're oftentimes being given from by individuals to the justices who either themselves have interest before the court or are donors to individuals who have interests before the court. So it's not just that, you know, these gifts are philanthropy or given out of friendship or closeness or affinity. It's sometimes, you know, if it isn't exactly corruption, it comes very close to that line. So, you know, it's my view that the justices, just like state officials in Illinois, just like federal officials who are elected and appointed in the executive and legislative branches, should not be accepting any gifts. It should be pretty cut and dried.
So to that point, and I know we've discussed this issue before when you've been on our show, you know, state court judges, local judges, all other judges are subject to federal and local disclosure laws. In this case, are there any disclosure laws that are being violated by the justices by accepting these gifts, or at least compromised in some way?
Yeah, so justices are supposed to report any gift that they receive that's greater than a certain dollar figure. So that dollar figure changes with inflation. Currently in 2024 and last year, for the reports that just came out, 2023, it was $480. So first of all, if you're a judge and I give you a $479 gift, it should be reported, but it's not reportable, which is crazy. Every gift should be reportable if we are in the business of saying that gifts are okay. And I don't think that we should be, but to the extent that we are, a gift over, you know, $50 should be reportable, not, you know, just under $480. And the disclosure rules don't really, I mean, they exempt a lot of things, right? If you are given personal hospitality at a friend's home, but that friend has a case before the court, or that friend works for, you know, just to use an example, Justice Kavanaugh, one of his best friends, works for Facebook. And Facebook often has cases that come before the court. And I don't think that Justice Kavanaugh is staying at his friend's house, but if he were, he might not have to report it under the current disclosure rules because it falls under this sort of amorphous personal hospitality exemption. And so, you know, I think that that's something, that's another loophole that Justice Thomas himself has used to say, oh, well, you know, Harlan Crow is my friend. I'm just going on my friend's yacht or my friend's plane. Never mind that Harlan Crow himself owns neither the yacht nor the plane. Crow Holdings owns the yacht, and Herzner, it's hard to pronounce, LLC, but a corporation, owns the plane. So it's not really personal hospitality unless corporations are people, and they might be under Supreme Court precedent, but that's probably a different legal face-off. Point is that there are a ton of loopholes, and the justices, because there is no one really holding them to account and no one's going to impeach and remove them, because that's really the only accountability measures we have, you know, they're just sort of either lying or omitting things that I think should be reportable.
It's just quite amazing, right? I mean, sometimes we all take a step back and like look at the things we're talking about these days versus even a few short years ago. Who would have thought that, you know, we'd have to get into a deep dive of whether any rules or laws are being violated when one of the nine most important jurists in the country is taking yacht trips and, you know, private jet trips and trips to Indonesia. But as you mentioned, Clarence Thomas is the king of the free gifts, right? He, in your great report, it's revealed that he received 103 gifts with a total value of more than $2.4 million. That's million with an M, between 2004 and 23. In contrast, to your point, Thomas's fellow justices over that same period received just 93 gifts, receiving or the value of $248,000. What do you make of this dramatic disparity?
Yeah, I mean, clearly one justice is not like the other. You know, one thing that's worth mentioning is that, you know, Thomas's gifts, you know, when he goes on these luxury trips, you know, that whole process is paid for by his quote unquote friends. Justice Scalia did a similar thing, but he was, I guess, smart enough, let's say, or into the loophole enough that he would have a local university pay for his travel and a local university pay for his hotels before he went on his luxury hunting and fishing trip. So he'd get, you know, Texas Tech or Baylor Law School to pay for his flight from DC and to pay for his lodging. And then once he was already there, he would have someone, you know, take him to a nearby hunting lodge where he would, you know, stay for free and hunt for free. So he was able to sort of reduce his burden, so to speak, and showing up in that spreadsheet with the six-figure number and not a seven-figure number. But yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that we hear about the Supreme Court, it's, you know, nine justices, nine law firms, and it's frankly incredibly frustrating and just, you know, downright disappointing that we have the justices interpreting the gift rules and their ethical responsibilities in such vastly different ways. I mean, we've heard of Justice Kagan refusing a basket of bagels from some friends of hers because she didn't want to violate the gift rules. You know, that couldn't have been worth more than, I mean, even if it was from Russ and Daughters in New York, which, you know, is way overpriced, and the bagels, those aren't the best bagels, but we can talk about that another time. They're not doughy enough. You know, even if it was the fanciest basket you could find, it was only a couple $100s, whereas Justice Thomas is totally okay with and not refusing gifts in the millions of dollars. So that to me is a concern, where you have, you know, the top legal officials in the country who are supposed to be looking at the laws similarly and disinterestedly, looking at the Constitution similarly and disinterestedly. But when it comes to their ethical responsibilities, they have completely different views.
Speaking of that, number two on the list of gift takers was Alito. Alito got about $170,000 worth of gifts in that same period, 16 gifts. Now, in light of what we've learned with his flags over his properties, he, of course, has blamed Mrs. Alito. What do you make of the overall belief that the court is nonpartisan? We know that the public has record low confidence in the courts. This disclosure by your organization can't help in light of what we now know about Justice Alito's very public views on some of these core issues.
Yeah, he is clearly a conservative partisan. I mean, he always has been. You know, there's an argument to be made that when you have a partisan actor, the president, nominating a justice confirmed by partisan actors, the Senate, you'd expect the entire court to be made up of Alitos. I mean, that's sort of the cynical view. Maybe not, you know, partisans on both sides, I guess, depending on who nominated and confirmed them. But at the same time, you should at least play the game of, oh, I am a neutral judge. I am a neutral individual who's just going to look at the letter of the law and not come up with some, you know, weird doctrine like originalism or the major questions doctrine or textualism to sort of like bolster my conservative bona fides, you know, or my conservative views. You know, with Justice Alito, he doesn't even play that game. And I think it's important for the confidence of the American people in the court to sort of at least believe that, okay, not every case do we know how you're going to decide. There's at least that veil of mystery. It's like, okay, you know, we know Justice Roberts is uber conservative, but sometimes he sides with the liberals, right? There's sort of that veil of, oh, well, you're not sure what he's going to do. We don't have that with Alito. And we can debate whether or not it's better to have more Robertses on the court and Alitos on the court. I'm obviously someone as a moderate who believes that there should be more Robertses. But, you know, with Alito, he's not even trying. And the problem is, when you show such partisan inclinations, you are in a lot of ways violating the ethical rules of the court. You're not supposed to participate in political activity. Flying a January 6th flag is a political activity. Doesn't matter if your wife did it. You're not supposed to espouse partisan views. Attacking the left and attacking ProPublica in the secret recording that was released a few weeks ago, those are partisan views. So, you know, even if you are a hardened partisan, you should at least sort of play the game, or at least participate as a justice in a way that doesn't, you know, let your conservative freak flag fly. It should be a little bit more, you know, decorous, and Alito clearly doesn't care.
It should be noted before we let you go, Gabe, that, you know, Democrat-appointed justices aren't immune from this discussion also. Ketanji Brown Jackson, the newest justice, is the one that took some Beyonce tickets, right? We'll let you go with the bagel discussion. The best bagels, I mean, none of those New York places hold a candle to the best bagel shop in my hometown, Montreal, Fairmount Bagels. You're not going to find a better bagel anywhere on this planet, Ryan. Yeah.
Montreal bagels are not bagels. That's my view.
By the way, I just looked up, associate justices right now make $298,500 annually. The Chief Justice makes $312,000 annually. Both went up $13,000. So you think that eventually they'd be able to pay for their own.
I think we should pay them more, frankly. I think we should pay them closer to $500,000. You know, I think that there's, you know, if they were in private practice, they'd be making 10 times that. And so, you know, just so that we're clear that they shouldn't be accepting gifts and they should be able to afford to fly wherever the hell they want to fly. Yeah, let's bump their salary. Like, you know, we want people in public service, and we don't, you know, obviously $300,000 is not a vow of poverty on the, you know, but if, when you know you could be making $3 million elsewhere, you know, we want more people in public service. We should pay our public servants better. And it shouldn't just be rich people who can afford to be in public service. So let's bump that up and let's ban gifts.
Yeah, quick prediction on the immunity case before we let you go. Very quick.
It's a mess of an opinion. He wins on some points. He loses on some points. And we're all left within a place where there's no trial until after the election. I think it's going to be a mixed bag.
Looking forward to all of it. Gabe Roth with Fix the Court. Thank you so much for joining us again on Legal Face Off.
Thanks for having me.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Stephen Wormiel is a professor of practice at law at American University's Washington College of Law. We've had about 8 or 9 Supreme Court opinions come down over the last couple of days. We're still awaiting some of the big ones involving former President Trump. Mr. Wormiel, thanks for joining us on Legal Face-Off to talk about that.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, some important decisions, some in a normal term that would probably make a lot more news. But as Ryan mentioned, Professor, we still don't have an immunity decision. It's been about 100 days since the court agreed to take the case. I mean, they decided Bush v. Gore in a day, and they're waiting this long. Of course, it's already a victory for Trump that the decision is taking this long. When do you expect to hear, and what does the delay itself tell us about how they might rule?
Well, the court term is supposed to wrap up next week. They have more opinions on Wednesday. They'll probably add 1 or 2 more days after that. Possible it goes into the following week. So we'll get the decision sometime in the next week, I would say. I think the longer it's taking, the more likely it is that they are planning a far-reaching opinion. In other words, 2 ways this could have gone. How does the Constitution affect Trump? Or more broadly, what's the fundamental question about presidential immunity for all time? And I think the longer it's taking, the more likely it is that we're going to see an all-time decision, not just the Trump decision.
Professor, the court overturned an ATF regulation, which was enacted during the Trump administration after the Las Vegas mass shooting, which defined a semi-automatic rifle equipped with a bump stock attachment as machine gun. Machine guns are generally prohibited under federal law. So what's your take on this Justice Thomas-led majority opinion?
Well, I got to say, first of all, I would urge everybody to find the opinion online and take a look at it. I've never seen anything quite like it. It has several diagrams of triggers and images of how one pulls a trigger and how a trigger acts. Quite remarkable. I mean, this is an opinion that literally turns on how Clarence Thomas sees guns working. And so the diagrams are fascinating. It's a very legally literal and technical decision. The law, when it says it prohibits machine guns, says it prohibits a gun for which the firing only requires one pull of the trigger and then it keeps firing. And that's the definition of a machine gun. The critics of bump stock said, well, that's kind of like what a bump stock does. It makes it easier to rapid fire. And Clarence Thomas says, no, a machine gun is a machine gun. Bump stocks are something else. And they're not the same thing. And the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms didn't have the authority to regulate bump stock.
So another decision, this time the court unanimously ruled to dismiss the case challenging the approval of the widely used abortion drug mifepristone, though the ruling preserved medication abortion access. It left the door open to future challenges by lower courts and state legislatures. Do you anticipate that this issue will be litigated again?
I think it will be litigated again, but I think it's complicated by this decision. What the court said in this case is that the group of doctors and individual doctors who are anti-abortion don't have an injury. In order to go into federal court, you have to be an injured party. And the court said they weren't injured parties. So the question is, there's no doubt that anti-abortion groups will want to litigate this further, but the question will be, what injury are they going to show? And this decision might actually, although it won't stop them from suing, it might make it more difficult for them to actually get the court's attention because it's not clear what their injury is going to be.
Professor, I don't know if you had a chance, probably not yet, to absorb the decision that came down today, the Rahimi case, that a little surprising to some, the court said that at least some people subject to domestic violence restraining orders do not have a categorical right to own a firearm. They upheld the law preventing one from doing so. Again, this has been a very pro-Second Amendment court. We know the Bruin decision greatly expanded the rights of folks to own arms if there's a historical tradition to owning them. So, you know, the decision is a little meandering. There's lots of concurring and dissenting opinions. How do you reconcile, if you've had time to consider, how do you reconcile this one with Bruin? And importantly, how do you think, do you pick up the Hunter Biden case, right? Which, if you're pro-Second Amendment, you probably feel that Hunter Biden was in the right in that case by, you know, being able to own a gun on constitutional grounds. That whole form that he was convicted of lying on should not, you know, is inconsistent with Bruin, really.
Yeah, I did have a chance to read it this morning. I think two things. One is, as you said, the court basically says that Congress had the power properly to stop domestic violence abusers who are under court orders from owning guns, that was a legitimate use of Congress's power and didn't violate the Second Amendment right to have a gun. The second important point is in Bruin, the court said 2 years ago that the way to measure whether government can regulate guns or not is to look at whether there's a history and tradition of regulating in a particular way. If there is a history and tradition, then government can restrict the guns. If there is no history and tradition, government has to take hands off and let people own their guns. Today, the court clarified that with eight justices agreeing, although, as you said, many of them wanting to explain it separately, that it doesn't have to be a perfect match. When we say history and tradition, you don't have to be able to say, well, here's the exact same law in 1800 or 1905. It has to be close. It has to be the idea that people who threaten physical harm to others have historically been prohibited from owning guns. But you don't have to actually be able to show that there was a ban on domestic abusers owning guns 150 years ago or 200 years ago. So it clarifies how precise the court is going to interpret that Second Amendment standard. And I think that's a really important point. The court over and over said it was providing guidance to the lower courts, which have been confused and divided on how to deal with that history and tradition rule.
Last question here, Professor. We're going to be talking here in a few minutes about this Louisiana law that allows the Ten Commandments to be displayed in public schools. That seems destined for the Supreme Court. Normally, you would think that it's a no-brainer for that kind of law to violate the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. But given some of the rulings lately, it doesn't seem to be as open and shut. And this case might, I mean, it's certainly going to get to the Supreme Court. And it's not as clear that would be struck down as it used to be.
I agree with you completely. This court is moving away from what's called the Establishment Clause and more toward protection of displays and professions of religion. Interestingly, there is only one justice left on the court from the 2005 decision when the court said you couldn't display the Ten Commandments in the lobby of the courthouse in Kentucky. The only justice left on the court from that decision is Clarence Thomas, and he thought then that you could display the Ten Commandments in the courthouse. So you got eight other justices. The conservative trend has been very strongly toward allowing displays of religious belief and religious faith. They allowed a 70-foot-high cross on public land in Maryland, and there have been other examples as well. So I think it's going to come to the court as a previously settled but now open question.
And you bring up Justice Thomas's name again. That continues to pop up during this podcast today. Stephen Wormiel, professor at American University, thank you so much for jumping on with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off. Andrew Willinger is Executive Director of the Duke Center for Firearms Law. He joins us today as we explore the Hunter Biden appeal. Mr. Willinger, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And earlier this month, Hunter Biden was convicted on all three felony gun charges stemming from a federal law that makes it a crime to own a weapon while being an unlawful user of or addicted to illegal drugs. Many believe that he will appeal this decision, which we're going to talk about more in a minute. But first, earlier this week, Biden's lawyers filed and then quickly withdrew a motion seeking a new trial. What do we know about the filing and then immediate withdrawal of that motion?
Right. So we don't know a whole lot. It seems like the motion that was filed, it's now been taken off the docket, actually, but somebody had pulled it down. And it seems like it relates to a very technical procedural issue with Hunter Biden's request that the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which is one level above the District of Delaware where the trial took place, that appellate court review certain legal issues, including his Second Amendment arguments, before the trial. Now, the Third Circuit declined to do that, but the motion sort of relates to how the Third Circuit declined to do that and whether they issued a final order saying so. I'm not sure why it was withdrawn. That's a little bit odd, but in any event, I think it probably doesn't really have legs in terms of influencing what happens with the appeal, because it does seem to be a very narrow procedural question. And I don't think that Hunter Biden would be successful in making that argument to sort of throw out the jury's verdict.
Andrew, another significant case that came down just today is the Rahimi case, widely expected. And the court held that people who are under domestic violence restraining orders cannot possess firearms. Justice Roberts wrote the majority, a lot of dissenting opinions, a lot of concurring opinions. How do you think this reconciles with some prior decisions, obviously the most prominent being Bruin? And how do you think it'll affect the potential Hunter Biden constitutional issue?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Rahimi decision was There are a lot of opinions, and it's kind of you open the ruling and it's over 100 pages, but the actual majority opinion is only, I think, 18. And that's joined by eight justices are in that majority. So it's only Justice Thomas who actually dissents and would have struck down this law. I think the high level takeaway is that, you know, the court is maintaining the test that was introduced in Bruin 2 years ago. This test asking whether gun laws are consistent with the American historical tradition of gun regulation, asking for analogs from history to support modern gun laws. But the court says that this isn't an exercise in sort of finding an exact twin or a very closely similar law in the historical record. It's a little bit more flexible. The court talks about sort of underlying principles of historical laws and kind of taking those principles and applying them to the modern day. In terms of your question as to how this impacts Hunter Biden's appeal, you know, I don't know that it will actually have a huge impact. I think if anything, it may actually, this ruling may help him a little bit in the sense that this is a narrow decision by the Supreme Court, and the majority opinion emphasizes that the domestic violence law that it upheld has sort of unique aspects, right? There's a judicial finding that somebody poses a threat to an intimate partner. It's time limited. There are certain procedural protections in the underlying family court proceeding. And those aspects are not present in this unlawful user prohibition that's at issue in the Hunter Biden case.
Hunter Biden pursues an appeal. Many believe, and I'm one of those people, that it would in many ways put him on the same side as many conservative gun rights groups and against what some would say are the gun control efforts that his father has pursued as president. Do you think that there's a way for Hunter Biden to appeal here where it doesn't look like he's completely at odds with his father, particularly during his run for a second presidential term?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think, you know, one aspect of the appearance of the Second Amendment in Hunter Biden's defense is that it has kind of split in some ways the gun rights movement. So you have some organizations, I think chief among them, the NRA, that have basically come out and said, you know, we think this is the correct outcome. And we think that drug use and guns don't go together. This is the government was correct to charge Hunter Biden with violating this law and with lying on his transaction forms. And so they seem to be saying that, you know, we think this law is okay, and this prosecution is fine. You have some other groups, more sort of hardline gun rights groups, that have taken the opposite position and have said, you know, almost, you know, in some cases offered to help Hunter Biden formulate his arguments on appeal, maybe file briefs supporting him, and basically saying that, you know, regardless of the politics, we are against these types of gun regulations. So I think that's an interesting split in the gun rights movement that this has brought out. You know, as far as how this influences Joe Biden or impacts Joe Biden's re-election campaign, I don't know that it moves the needle a whole lot. I tend to think that people are pretty dug in on both sides in terms of how they view this, you know, whether they think this case is just the tip of the iceberg and there are other, you know, criminal endeavors that the Bidens are wrapped up in, or whether they think that this indicates respect for the rule of law, the fact that, you know, President Biden is actually allowing his Justice Department to prosecute and get a conviction of his own son.
Andrew, last question here. What do you make of the bump stock decision? Very technical decision. You know, had a lot of drawings and diagrams and a lot of analysis of what really goes into firing a firearm. But, you know, how is that not a machine gun? Or is the court saying, you know, let that decision go back to lawmakers where it should be? We don't want to deal with it.
Yeah, I think that is really the thrust of the decision. And you really see that in the concurrence by Justice Alito, where he actually says, you know, I think that these devices should be banned. And now that this decision has issued, Congress can and should act. I know that there was a bill introduced and it has been blocked, I believe, as of the current moment. But I mean, I think, you know, important to emphasize a couple of things about the decision. First is that a number of states continue to ban bump stocks. And I think it wouldn't surprise me if that number increased, if we see more states taking legislative action to ban these devices. And then I also think that it's, you know, the case and the decision are sort of emblematic of the Supreme Court maybe giving a little bit of closer scrutiny to these administrative law questions when they deal with firearms. And so another example of this is a case that the court has accepted to hear next term that deals with ghost guns. Where the Biden administration similarly sort of used existing statutes to regulate ghost guns.
Andrew Willinger with the Duke Center for Firearms Law. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Continuing with the Legal Face-Off podcast, we move into the legal grab bag. We're joined by Jill Griffin, a senior claims manager with a focus on workers' compensation and disabilities programs. I'm told she's got a lot of opinions and she's willing to share them. And we've got Sharon Fox, VP of Partnerships at Trust Layer. Today, Donald Trump's legal team is trying to get his Mar-a-Lago classified documents case tossed. And of course, we're waiting on what the Supreme Court says about his presidential immunity claim. Rich, want to dive into Trump Watch this week for us?
I mean, there's that. There's, you know, this disclosure that Eileen Cannon was advised by several senior judges to step down and let a more senior judge take the case. So, you know, I think everything's kind of on hold for Trump right now legally. We know that most of his cases are being stayed until after the election. The immunity decision is the next big thing, as we've now talked about on this show a lot, Tina. But, you know, in many ways, he won, right? He won by all of these legal issues being delayed until after the election. I don't think, quite frankly, that anyone would really be swayed. I mean, is any Trump voter not going to vote for him if any of these cases proceeded anyway? Everyone's making a big deal that, you know, the immunity is being delayed. Doesn't really matter. Anyone who's voting for Trump, in my opinion, would vote for him anyway. He's been convicted of 34 felonies, and that hasn't moved the needle. So I think in some ways the idea that this, you know, these other cases being delayed is overdone. You know, everyone's mind is made up. There's going to be like a 7 people in Wisconsin that decide this whole damn election anyway.
Well, you know, it's. I mean, this whole thing. I'm so glad we do Trump Watch each show because there's different stuff going on every time. You know, I think in some ways, what people are laser focused on is how the Supreme Court has significantly delayed this decision, Rich, to the point where, you know, the delay has, as you said, he's won because of the delay. I mean, there's a lot of speculation that even if the Supreme Court comes down in a way that is seen as sort of adverse to him, that this delay has been so meaningful. And, you know, people are talking about how it's a corrupt court because they could have easily decided this case many weeks ago, and they delayed the oral hearing, the oral arguments, and now here we are the last week of the term and we still don't have a decision. So it's all very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Jill, you remember Bush v. Gore. That case was decided in a day, literally. I mean, when these justices want to work and get a decision out, I mean, it's the Supreme Court. We've all worked under deadlines ourselves. The idea that these 9 people and their massive staffs can't get together and decide what legally should be a no-brainer, whether the highest court or highest, you know, officeholder in the land should be immune, I mean, that should be a no-brainer, yet they're dragging it out. Many say that it's because they want to delay it until after the election. What's your take on it? There's a lot of people saying...
Yeah, I think they absolutely can make the decision, right? I mean, there's no question about it. But it's all delay tactics from Trump over and over again. He's got people on his side are doing that. I mean, it's playing into his game that he's done for decades. And the Supreme Court certainly could weigh in on it. They're choosing not to. They're, you know, the stance that a lot of people are making is leave it for the American people to decide. I don't think that's the right approach, but that's the approach they're taking. And as you said, people have their mind made up. If they're going to vote for Trump and they shrug their shoulders and they say, so I'm voting for a felon. Oh, well, you know, he's my guy. I'll support him if he rules from prison. And there's other people on the other side that are you know, obviously saying that he should be disqualified. I think a decision could be made. I just think people don't want to make the decision.
Yeah, Sharon, the whole process has become obviously very politicized. The Supreme Court is supposed to be apolitical, but, you know, nonpartisan. You are joining us from our favorite neighbors, Canadians. you know, listen, Canada has its share of scandals. A lot of other countries have way worse scandals politically than this. But what's your take from your vantage point where, you know, you're not...
Well, we did have a crack smoking mayor, so there was that.
Late great Rob Ford.
Right. But I think, I mean, my family cringes when I say this, but I like Trump or not, you got to give the guy credit in terms of just like how he's been able to navigate so many different things in his life. Bankruptcies, presidency, now the appeals bond, last minute was able to come up with the money. Just this guy is untouchable, it seems, in terms of what he's able to skate by, you know? Presidency is like the most prestigious.
One more vote for Trump.
I'm not voting for him, but I'm like, it's pretty crazy what he's been able to accomplish, or not, for lack of a better term, I guess.
A lot of people talking about Canadian voters.
And what makes I think Canadians talk about him more than Americans do, probably. I think we're very ingrained in the U.S. election process in some way.
What adds to this a little bit, too, is the timing on this decision from the Supreme Court could come just before the debate, maybe even the day of the debate next week. We'll see. All right, moving along. Louisiana classrooms are now required by law to display the Ten Commandments. This, of course, will be challenged. Tina, you threw this in the back for us.
So this week, Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry signed into law a requirement that all of that state's public schools must display the Ten Commandments in all classrooms. The law actually provides exact language that must be included on these poster-sized displays that have or should have large, easily readable font, and that the text be in every classroom at schools that receive state funding from kindergarten through college. The governor called this legislation one of his favorites, with Louisiana being the first state in the country that has signed this type of bill into law. He claims that the Ten Commandments are the ultimate law that must be respected. And supporters of the law relied on the 2022 U.S. Supreme Court decision in Kennedy versus Bremerton School District, which gave a high school football coach his job back after he was disciplined over a controversy involving prayer on the field. The Supreme Court had ruled in that case that the coach's prayers amounted to private speech that was protected by the First Amendment and therefore could not be restricted by the school district. The court clarified that a government entity does not necessarily violate the Establishment Clause by permitting religious expression in public. Not surprisingly, opponents of this bill, including civil liberties groups, have argued that this violates the Establishment Clause, which says that Congress can make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And they also claim that it violates longstanding Supreme Court precedent and the First Amendment and would result in unconstitutionally coercing religion with students. So, Rich, we had touched on this earlier in the show. I absolutely agree that this is going to be appealed to the Supreme Court, but the way that the Supreme Court is constituted these days and how conservative it is, I'm not convinced at all that this is going to be overturned.
It's bananas. I mean, it's like, you know, at one point you can rely on something called precedent. I mean, there's precedent against these kind of cases. There's precedent against like the bump stock. Like it's wild that the Supreme Court now says, let's just take up any case that comes before us. It doesn't matter so much if we have standing, although they ruled against, in the abortion pill case, they ruled that case on standing. But
Is there any more obvious violation of the Establishment Clause than this? I mean, it's the 10 freaking commandments. I don't mean to use God's name in vain in this case, but it's the 10 commandments. It's a school. What if you don't believe? Like in Louisiana, 75% of students and the population in general is Christian. So I get it. There's like 1% Jewish, 1% Muslim. I get that population. But you're supposed to have rights for the minority. The very reason that there's an Establishment Clause is for that 1% of people who might not believe to have their voice heard too, so they're not pressured into following some dogma or doctrine that they don't believe in. So it's crazy. It shouldn't even be taken by the Supreme Court, given the precedent. But it will be, as you said, there's a good chance that it'll be upheld. So it's bananas. I listened to one of the legislators last night on CNN try to defend it. And I mean, I'm sure there are very articulate, eloquent people on their side of the aisle on this issue. This woman wasn't. She was babbling on and on. And she couldn't put together an argument explaining why this doesn't violate the Constitution. So I'd like to say it won't be upheld, Sharon and Jill, but I have a feeling there will be. Remember, the Supreme Court ruled recently, a couple of years ago, that a coach, a high school coach, could lead his team in prayer and kneel down. And this is a public school team, so this is the trend.
I just don't even understand the practicality of it. Like, what? Why are they trying to put this in the schools? You know, we're talking about kindergartners. They don't know what all this means. And frankly, I don't think there's a lot of threat. I'm not saying it doesn't exist that the kindergartners or elementary school are going to be murdering and committing adultery and all the things that are in the Ten Commandments. I think about my kids when they went to school. The schools had their own list of commandments, right? Like they had an acronym. I think it was respect, and everything stood for something. I don't see the value in using the commandments as they are at the elementary school level. And from what they're trying to say is that it's a basic moral compass everybody should live by. I think, there's much more teachable moments with kids besides just murder, generally being nice to each other and being friendly and respectful is far more important to teach the elementary school kids than whatever Moses said.
Yeah. And conversely, may be converse to what they're taught at home as well. And I think every time religion and politics collide, we see what happens, which is, it's not good for society.
Ryan, favorite commandment, go.
honor thy father and thy mother. There you go. Okay, moving on. A lawyer in Chicago is reportedly handcuffed to a chair after a judge ordered him removed last month. Now the state of Illinois is getting involved. Rich, you brought this one up.
Like more people would think that this was a good development than bad, but a story we're following closely. This is Judge Flanagan, Kathy Flanagan, who, lest she handcuffed me to a chair, I will say is one of the great jurists in our system. She has been around a long time. I've appeared before her many, many times, and she is known, Tina, as a very strict judge. Now, she's got to be. She runs the motion call, one of the busiest motion calls in the country. And as you can imagine, there's lots of lawyers who show up unprepared. Well, in this situation, there was an attorney who appeared before Judge Flanagan, and one thing led to another. She said that he was disrespectful and was misogynistic, and she had her deputy come and pull him in the back and handcuff him to a chair. Well, that sparked an inquiry by the state into her behavior in this situation. And so that's where we are right now. It, again, is a very big story here locally because almost every attorney at some point has their own interesting story with Judge Flanagan because, again, she is very strict in how she applies the rules. So this is one case where, they're looking into what she did. She has come out very articulately and said that she is not to blame and she did nothing wrong. We'll see what develops. But Tina, interesting story out of Cook County.
It is an interesting story. And as you said, Rich, everybody knows Judge Flanagan. She's been a judge for a long time. So, it's it's a bit baffling. I mean, we all know she has a strict, she runs a strict courtroom, but this was a bit over the top, I think, you know, assuming it's true, which I think we all should. I would be surprised if they do anything significant against her. They may say, you know, this is not necessarily the type of reaction that was warranted given the circumstances. And I wouldn't, and maybe give her a free pass, but it is definitely an odd story.
Jill, the judge did let the attorney go after a few minutes. Perhaps she was trying to send a message. And again, if you've ever been in front of Judge Flanagan or really any judge in Cook County, again, it's in many ways a cattle call. There's a lot of people coming in and out. It's very hard to hear. You know, it's very hard to get anything done in a quick basis, on a quick basis as they have to. So I understand why judges have to be very strict and people are frequently not prepared. But what do you think? Did she go too far in handcuffing this lawyer?
You know, it's hard to say without really being there. I thought I read that the attorney was approaching the bench and not being disrespectful. And I don't know the mindset, right? You say the same thing when you look retrospectively as how the police responded. Sometimes they use too much force. Sometimes they're reacting. I don't know, you know, per se, what was happening in that court at that time. If she felt that she was losing control and she had to take that extreme of a measure to get control of the situation, it is her courtroom. I do agree that it probably, in retrospect, was a extreme measure, and that's probably why she decided not to detain him any further.
And did this get any play on the general news desk?
Well, we get a little bit of it. WGN, we did mention it a few times, yeah. But I wasn't major, but I can imagine in those circles it would be. All right, well, a California lawyer tried to trademark the phrase Trump too small. That's T-O-O. Tina, what happened in this case?
So Ryan, in a unanimous decision last week, the Supreme Court rejected the California lawyer's attempt to obtain a federal trademark registration for the phrase Trump too small. This phrase is in reference to some sparring back in 2016 between Donald Trump and Senator Marco Rubio during a presidential primary debate. During the debate, Rubio said Trump had small hands and said, and you know what they say about guys with small hands. And of course, Trump engaged and responded to that. The lawyer, his name is Steve Elster, and he said that in filing for the application for registration of this phrase, that he wanted to convey the message that some features of President Trump and his policies are diminutive. So he would use the phrase on the front of T-shirts with a list of Trump's positions on the back. This case did not address whether Elster could actually use the phrase on these items. It only addressed whether he could obtain a federal trademark registration for the phrase. So for those of our listeners out there who happen to be trademark lawyers like I am, you know that there is a provision in trademark law that prohibits registering trademarks that identify a living individual without their written consent. So because Elster didn't get Trump's consent to use his name in this trademark, the trademark office refused registration. Interestingly, on appeal, the Federal Circuit ruled that the First Amendment trumped the office and allowed the registration and referenced the fact that Trump is a public official really tilted this analysis towards protection of the speech under the First Amendment. What's interesting is that this was a unanimous decision, as I mentioned, but there were very sharply divided rationales, with Justice Thomas using the Second Amendment history-based methodology, which we discussed earlier in our show about when we talked about Bruin. And said that for that reason, that this case should be decided and it's not really a First Amendment issue. What's interesting is Justice Sonia Sotomayor was very critical and in her concurring opinion came out with a scathing discussion where she compared the majority opinion to entering a crowded cocktail party that you're not invited to and looking over everyone's heads to find your friends. And she said, it's just ludicrous that the majority is using this analysis that's used in gun cases, Second Amendment cases, for this type of a case. So, Rich, this is just more of the same that we've been seeing, particularly over the last couple of years, with just really sharp divides among the Supreme Court justices, even ones that politically tend to be aligned, like Justice Thomas and Amy Coney Barrett. So I can only imagine what the next week is going to hold in terms of ending the term.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to me, sort of the big picture take on this is how this fits into the overall, you know, erosion perhaps of some IP protection that we're seeing across the board. I mean, in some respects, you know, courts are being more protective of IP rights. We see that when we discuss a lot of the attempts by artists to, you know, protect their music and their art. On the other hand, you know, in the age of AI, it seems like the ability to protect some of this IP is more difficult than ever. So, you know, we're definitely entering a whole new world of IP when you consider how much is out there and how much is being stolen every day. I mean, we're just scratching the surface of intellectual property theft when you consider, you know, how many foreign actors there are, how many unknown actors there are, and the ability of AI to grab all this stuff. So, you know, on the other hand, we also just got to thank Trump. Another Trump landmark legal ruling, Jill. He continues to, in the stupidest ways, give us some insight into some important issues.
Yeah, I think you said it earlier that everything old is new again. We keep the precedents, they apply when they want to apply. They don't apply when they don't want them to apply. Everything is being rehashed over and over again. Something like the trademark should be very clear. All of a sudden it goes through the legal system. It goes to appeal and we got to wait to figure out where it's going to land.
Well, Morgan Wallen took a break this week. Thank goodness. But the celeb arrest blotter was working overtime. Both Justin Timberlake and Travis Scott were arrested for different reasons. I can tell Sharon's got some thoughts on this. Tina, what's going on with these singers?
So, you know, we regularly talk on the Grab Bag about celebrities behaving badly. And so we've got two this week within a couple of days of each other. The first being Justin Timberlake, who was arrested earlier this week on Long Island and was charged with driving while intoxicated after he allegedly had driven through a stop sign and was failing to keep to the right side of the road. The officer on the scene said that Timberlake was in a clearly intoxicated condition, that his eyes were bloodshot and glassy. He had a strong odor of alcohol and that he had performed poorly on all of the standard field sobriety tests. And he also refused a breath test three times, apparently. He was arraigned late Tuesday morning and he was released. And of course, he's in the middle of a tour and is actually supposed to be performing here tonight in Chicago at the United Center, as well as tomorrow night, and his upcoming shows at Madison Square Garden and in Boston and Baltimore over the next couple of weeks. And it actually looks like he's up for a hearing in late July when he's actually going to be touring in Poland. So, but you know, the show's got to go on. So you JT fans out there, don't worry. The hearing's going to be virtual and his lawyer is going to be attending in his stead. In other news, Travis Scott was arrested yesterday morning on charges associated with alcohol. Also this time disorderly intoxication. He was in Miami at the Miami Beach Marina, and he was apparently fighting with a bunch of people on a yacht. He was found yelling at them. He would not follow officers' commands to sit down. He was clearly intoxicated. They walked him off the dock. Then he came back a few minutes later and continued screaming. He was arrested and released on a $650 bond. This is not the first time we're talking about Travis Scott here on Legal Face-Off. He seems to have a lot of legal run-ins that happen at his concerts, with the most famous, unfortunately, being 3 years ago at the Astroworld Festival, which turned into a deadly tragedy and 10 casualties. And in late May, he beat up Cher's boyfriend. So Travis Scott continues to keep us entertained and gives us fodder for the grab bag, Rich.
He's drunk. And by the way, he also beat up Cher's boyfriend. You ever think you say those words on a podcast? Who's Cher's boyfriend? The last Cher's boyfriend I remember was the bagel guy. Remember the bagel guy? Back in the 90s? Cher. Huh. Anyway, I got off on a Cher tangent there for a second. Also, I love the fact, Ryan and Tina, that he was arrested for disorderly intoxication. Like, you know, there's gregarious intoxication. If you're just a happy drunk, all's good. But don't be disorderly while you're drunk down in Florida. Then you're going to get arrested. I don't know. I mean, obviously not good. Like, you think these guys would have enough sense and certainly money, Sharon, to, like, I don't know, call an Uber? I mean, Uber X.
They could call the gardener. They could call the nanny. They could call. But I think it's that, like, invincible element of these people. But I don't know if you've seen the virality around what Timberlake said, I guess, under his breath to the cop. He said, this is going to ruin the tour. And so the internet's just having a field day around, like, anything bad that happens in your life now, that's going to be, like, the quintessential quote.
Not the tour. Forget about, you know, the person I might have killed. Like, drunk. It's going to, but the greatest part also is the cop didn't know who he was. You know, I mean, not for nothing, but JT's what, like 48 by now? The average 27-year-old has no idea who Timberlake is, nor did this cop.
What do you guys think the Uber surge prices are at the Hamptons that he refused to take that? And they must have crazy surge pricing.
I was like, this is $17. Forget it. I'm going to just roll the dice, drive my $700,000 vehicle.
All right. Well, a billionaire heir to Coca-Cola has been ordered to pay $900 million to a former employee over alleged sexual assaults. Rich, what do you have for us on this story?
You know, the takeaway here, I mean, it's a crazy story. It's like they called him the world's worst boss on one of my chief sources of all news, Inside Edition. You know, the headline was the world's worst boss because he's had to pay, you know, in anyone's world, like paying a $10 million judgment would be the worst thing ever. That pales in comparison to, you heard it right, $900 million, which I believe has got to be a record in employment law, you know, verdicts. And this is just stemming from a one-time incident. This guy, I mean, he made all his money from a family Coca-Cola bottling company, as Ryan mentioned. Also, he's like the king of these hologram shows where you bring back artists from the dead and people pay somehow to see, like, Michael Jackson and ABBA. Not that ABBA's dead, but is ABBA dead? Maybe not. I think most of ABBA's alive. But there is an ABBA hologram show. But this guy, $900 million. I mean, I don't know that would be upheld on appeal, Tina. Not to say that what he did doesn't deserve a huge award. So hopefully he won't do it again, but $900 million is a lot.
Yeah, I agree, Rich. I would fully expect this decision to be appealed. And I don't know how you arrive at $900 million. And as you said, it's not that, of course, what he did was terrible. It's just the amount is pretty steep. And I do think that it was intentional in terms of the amount being as high as it was, maybe with the hope that, you know, he'll actually stop doing and engaging in this terrible behavior that he's been convicted of engaging in. So, but it is staggering. I think it is the largest of these.
But maybe the right amount. I mean, Jill, I mean, this guy was accused of having a rape room. And again, you know, raping and sexually assaulting this woman repeatedly over 3 years, Jane Doe. So, you know, listen, maybe this will send the message to people like this. He's, you know, his estimated worth is, like, you know, well north of $1 billion, that maybe they're not above the law, you know, so maybe it's the right decision.
Yeah, Coca-Cola is probably one of the most recognizable names. So I think to send a message, $900 million, you know, the message is going to get out. Everybody knows Coca-Cola. The name's going to come up on all the social media hits that shows Coca-Cola. The message is going to get around. I think a lot of that is just making an example out of him. And yeah, I agree. It'll get knocked down in appeal. But I think the judge was looking to make a statement there.
Yeah, Sharon, this in the past, he and his company have been ordered to pay $70 million in damages in the past. So that probably also played into the decision here that he's a repeat offender.
Well, that, and I think the family brand that ties into the judgment as well. So, because to a billionaire, $1 million is not a meaningful amount of money. So what is to actually send a message? Because it was pretty nefarious and egregious things, acts that he was getting away with for a long time. So.
All right, moving on to our last one. And Rich, I'm going to need your help on this one. Ohio Supreme Court reinstates lawyer who? Finish it off for us.
Pooped in the Pringles can. Is that the, that's what you're looking for. It's just your standard everyday case about crapping in a snack container. I mean, I think we might have covered this the first time, Tina, that he was, you know, disbarred. That was back in 2001 when surveillance cameras recorded this guy. His name is Jack Blakesley of Noble County, Ohio. In November of 21, he was caught on camera dropping a Pringles potato can, chip can, into the parking lot of a crime victim advocacy center. So not just any parking lot, you know, but victims of crime, that's where they go. He had to do it there. The can contained human feces, as we talked about. We're not sure whose feces it was. It was him, but he was disbarred. And now he has rehabbed enough for them to give him his license back. He said that he did not target anyone and said that he pulled the Pringles prank at least 10 times in 2021. He had known this victim's advocate center for years. He was scheduled to see them in court before this. He was a criminal defense lawyer. But again, now he's back in court to hoop and toss again, perhaps, Tina. I mean, I don't know. It's, you know, clearly.
I would like to think that part of the rehab involves, you know, somewhere along the line saying, I'm not going to do this again. But my money is that he is going to do this again. And that we are going to be having this conversation on Legal Grab Bag within 12 months. Who's taking the bet?
It's clear that he doesn't give a crap, Sharon, about his reputation or the practice of law.
I don't know. You guys should be embarrassed that that's your community there. I'm just kidding. But yeah.
But what? His mind is a whole legal process, someone said.
God, does he give anybody a legal license these days?
Exactly. Jill, you deal with lots of lawyers. You've seen some nutty behavior over the years, but
oh yeah, for sure.
Do you ever open a? I used to think the only danger of opening a Pringles can was that snake that
the,
you
snake,
know, it will pop out. Now I'm never eating any Pringles ever again.
You know, I can't help thinking the standards at the bar, there should be repercussions for that. And then I think about this being Ohio and all the outrage over this Pringles can by the same people that are going to vote for a felon. I think there needs to be accountability. I think there needs to be, I hate to say common sense, but there needs to be some logic with the people that we hold to esteem in this country. And lawyers, I don't know, ambulance chasers, lawyers, but certainly they do represent the people and you know, they should be held to a standard.
So what you're saying is you think Trump could get away with it, is what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. His diaper was full, right?
A lot of people saying it's just a Pringles can. I mean, there's a lot of people. It does beg the question, Ryan, of what you have to do in Ohio to lose your license. If it's not this, what do you have to do? And by the way, one time, two times, three times, 11 times. You know what they say, the old saying. Shit
in a makes perfect.
One, shame on me. Shit in Pringles twice, shame on you. Something like that. But,
well, any publicity is good publicity, but I don't think this is good publicity for Pringles.
That's true. Let's end our segment by learning a little bit, Tina, about our friends. We won't ask about what your favorite snack food to poop in is, but we will ask, speaking of Justin Timberlake, member of famous boy band NSYNC, what is your favorite boy band of all time? You can't say NSYNC. That's already been taken. Your favorite boy band of all time. We're going to start with our friend from Canada.
First concert I ever went to. Yeah. New Kids on the Block.
NKOTB.
I know.
Wow.
You know the acronym.
Home of fellow Celtics fan, Donnie Wahlberg.
Jill Griffin, you grew up in the era of the boy bands.
Actually, I'm a little before the era of the boy bands.
Trying to be a little bit nicer, but that's
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, you know, I went to one of those local cover bands that hit all the fests here in Chicago a couple weeks ago. And they, you know, like I said, cover band of boy bands. And have a good time going to that. And they changed their set this year, and they include some groups that I never thought of as boy bands before. The Beach Boys, The Temptations. That was really cool to think of it from that perspective. So I think I'm a little more old school in my thought on boy bands at this time.
Well, Beach Boys, yeah. Some would say Tina, the world's one of the earliest boy bands, was four kids from Liverpool.
Well, the Beatles, I would not think of them as a boy band. I mean, if I had to sort of think of my traditional sense of what a boy band is, I'd say Duran Duran.
Hungry yeah. like the wolf, not the fox. Ryan Burr.
Yeah, I'm a kid of the 90s, so, you know, that whole from New Kids on the Block, Belle Biv DeVoe, you could take it up. Well, I'm not going to go as far as Hanson, but yeah, I mean, Belle Biv DeVoe, I guess, was I guess you would consider them a boy band. Yeah.
Hey, they were spin off of New Edition, right?
Yeah.
They were New Edition minus Bobby Brown.
The East Coast band.
And New Edition was amazing. I got some words for you. You ready? Why are you all coming down on me trying to tell me how my life is supposed to be? I know you're only trying to help me out, trying to tell me what life is really about, but it's time I'm going to make it on my own. So why don't you fellas just leave us alone? Ronnie, Bobby, Ricky, and Mike, Philo, who cares who you like?
Cool it now.
Cool it now. I will leave you with my favorite boy band, of course, Harry Styles, Zayn, Liam, One Direction, the best boy band in history.
You met them, didn't you?
Maybe that's for another show, Jill.
All righty.
That's why.
Maybe I partied. Maybe I partied with 1D one night, and
you might be the reason they broke up, Rich. I don't know.
Yeah.
Of 1D.
I hope they all should turn up somewhere down the line. I hope they are successful at some point. All right, well, thank you so much, Sharon Fox of Trust Layer, and Jill Griffin, our senior claims manager. And that'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Special thanks to Gabe Roth of Fix the Court. We had Chicago Inspector General Deborah Witzberg. We had Professor Stephen Wormiel of American University and Andrew Willinger of Duke Center for Firearms Law. Also, Ben Anderson, Lisa Stiegel, and we've got Rich's dog. Rich, what's the dog's name?
Ziggy Stardust.
Ziggy Stardust. I call it Ziggs. So for Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff, I'm Ryan Bro. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...